So we're looking at John chapter 9 tonight and exploring one of the major themes that comes through in this chapter. During Jesus' early ministry, and then later on in the first decades of the early church, Christianity was confronted with a major challenge. It had to answer the question of why the Jews, God's own precious people, had not recognized that their Messiah and Savior had come in the person of Jesus Christ. What early Christianity needed was a nuanced account of why some Jews recognized who Jesus was, that he was sent from God as his Christ, but why many of the Jews, even the majority of them, were completely unable to see this. Even today, some have argued that if the smartest rabbis and Jewish theologians of Jesus' day did not think that he was the Messiah, then that ought to present a serious challenge to our belief that he was. In fact, we could extend this further. There are many intellectuals and philosophers and scientists who, though they know so much, do not believe. And this can be a serious challenge to our faith. Are we believing in spite of the evidence? Are we believing in spite of the truth? Through thinking about this passage, I'm hoping that we'll see that what someone is willing to accept is far more complex than we often imagine, that sin can actually affect our minds, and does affect the minds of those quote-unquote experts who, in their attack on Christianity, cause so much confusion. Let's ask ourselves this. What does it mean to be able to see spiritually? Or maybe let's reframe the question to fit with the passage. What does it mean to not be able to see spiritually? If you look with me at verse 39, towards the end of our reading, Jesus is recorded as saying, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." There has obviously been a physical healing. A man who was physically blind has had his sight miraculously restored, and so those who are blind now see. But what of those who saw and are now blind? This theme of spiritual blindness coming on the Jews is developed much more in the rest of the gospel, and it's part of a larger narrative which John is telling, that God has come into the world, that he has taken on flesh, and he has dwelt among us. Jesus, the Son, is now once and for all making known to the Jews his Father, of whom he is the perfect image and likeness. The deeds that Jesus does are the deeds that his Father is doing. And there is this beautiful, incredibly close connection that Jesus describes between the Father and the Son. Jesus shows us exactly how wonderful and good and true is his Father. These works, in fact, are the works particularly that God had promised to do in the Old Testament, in the Messianic age to come, when God would come and deal with the problems of this world. There were prophecies specifically telling that God would give sight to the blind. And so because Jesus is doing these mighty signs, which are the very works of God, it ought to be so clear, this Jesus, he must be from God. It is the inability to see this that is the Pharisees' spiritual blindness, their failure to see that he comes from God that means they are blind. As they say, we do not know where he comes from. But secondly, why is it the Jews can't see? What is preventing these Pharisees from being able to see as they ought? If we look again at verse 39, we can see that this lack of spiritual sight has to do with judgment. For judgment I came into this world. And so there is this judgment that is this blindness. The judgment causes them to become blind. And this judgment isn't presented in the form that we typically conceive judgment as taking. The judgment was happening then. It was occurring as Jesus spoke. Often we tend to see judgment as something that will happen in the future, something set for a day to come. And this view of a future judgment is all over the New Testament, and it's in John as well. But the fact that the New Testament's focus is on a judgment in the future should not mean that we neglect to see what the New Testament teaches us about the judgment that is occurring in the present, the judgment that's occurring now. In fact, in John's Gospel, it is this imminent judgment which is foremost in the evangelist's focus. John writes primarily on the judgment that occurred when Jesus came the first time, not the judgment when he comes the second time. And so what Jesus is talking about is an imminent judgment. And this imminent judgment has already been described a number of times. For example, John chapter 3, verse 17, in which we read, "For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, and whoever does not believe is condemned already. And this is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and the people loved the darkness more than the light, for their deeds were evil." The judgment is the light's coming into the world with the express purpose not of condemning the world, but of rescuing it. And yet, despite the fact that the purpose of the light's coming into the world is not for judgment, the judgment still follows from the choice evildoers made to ignore the light, a choice they made because, as we read, their deeds were evil. The judgment is, in fact, that there were men who were offered rescue and salvation, but chose their sin instead, and that by that choice they separate themselves from God, and in doing this they become blind. Their evil deeds and their choice to commit those evil deeds mean that they're no longer able to see God, no longer able to recognize him that is all light. What we have is a reciprocal relationship. The judgment is that the evil, of doing of evil, actually warps the mind and the spiritual eye such that it becomes less and less able to recognize what is good. And as the mind becomes harder and harder, more and more evil is done, it becomes a vicious cycle. We see this in our story. Sin destroys the Pharisees' ability to think properly. Looking back at the narrative, we see, well, what we have is rather a strange account. We have an uneducated beggar who is in a theological battle against the leading Jewish scholars, the ones who have devoted their lives to God, the ones who pride themselves on being distinct, on being holy and better educated in the things of God. And on the other side, we have a poor blind beggar just cured from blindness. He had, I assume, for all of his life belonged to the dregs of society. He was uneducated, no doubt, and suspected to be morally compromised, as we see at the beginning, or at least his parents. And as they argue, the beggar is trying to communicate a very simple point. If you look with me at verse 25, we read that he says of Jesus, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I know, that I was blind and now I see." And he goes on in verse 30 to say, "This is an amazing thing, that you do not know where he comes from, yet he opened the eyes of the blind. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshipper of God and does his will, God will listen to him. That this man was not from God, he could do nothing." The arguments here aren't particularly advanced or particularly sophisticated, just very simply, I was blind and now I see, and this curing of my blindness is so obviously an act of God that this man also must be from God. I think John, in telling this story, wants us to know that if our brains or minds, or rather our spiritual eyes, are working properly, it doesn't take years of study to know who Jesus is. It doesn't take a high IQ. Even a beggar can see and understand. All that is needed is for our spiritual eyes to be open. But the Pharisees, well, their eyes are fast shut. They cannot see what ought to be most obviously clear. And so they do not appear to be able to grasp even the beggar's very simple argument. Instead of actually answering the beggar, the Pharisees reply in verse 34. And they say, "You were born in utter sin and would teach us." They assume that someone must have sinned, whether the parents or the man, and thus they take it to follow that everything he says must be both worthless and wrong. But their response also demonstrates what's actually going on here. The Pharisees cannot and will not accept Jesus as being from God, for he exposes them for what they are. And so they'll resort to any argument, even if it's simply an insult, in order to avoid accepting the obvious conclusions that follow from what they've seen, what they've heard about, and the beggar's testimony. "You were born in utter sin and would teach us" is not an argument. There isn't a good argument to defend their position. Reason for the Pharisees seems to have just been overtaken by anger and rage. They're fleeing from the light of truth, and they're left with only fury and vile insults. In Dante's Inferno, as Dante enters hell in this journey that he goes in, and just after we have those famous words, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," Virgil, who's acting as Dante's guide, describes to Dante that those they are seeing now in hell, in this poem, this medieval poem, have lost the good of the intellect. That through their choice to reject God, they've also rejected truth. And so their minds have become unable to pursue that which is right and good. Perhaps we could say the same thing of our Pharisees. Though they're not yet in hell, the same judgment has fallen on them. They also seem to have lost the good of their intellects. In their hatred of Jesus, God has given all of us reason, but that reason ought to lead us to Jesus. It leads the blind man to understanding that this man must be from God. If you notice earlier on, he wasn't sure whether this man is a sinner or not. I do not know. But eventually, by reasoning things through, he comes to see very clearly. God does not listen to sinners. This man can't be a sinner. That's where reason ought to have taken the Pharisees too. But to maintain their position, to avoid the light shining on them and exposing them, they've had to forsake reason. In way of summing up then, I hope that what we've been able to see is that when we talk about what we can see spiritually, whether assessing the claims of Jesus or the truth of Christianity, it's not just a question of kind of abstract reason and rationality. It's deeply informed by what we do as well. The Pharisees could not see Jesus or see who he was, for as John writes earlier, their deeds were evil. And so from this case study of how spiritual blindness has fallen on the Pharisees, I think we can draw some practical inferences. Sometimes we can think that becoming a Christian ought to be a purely rational activity. And there's a danger when we're talking to non-Christians and presenting them with Christian apologetics that we can think that if we just present the arguments simply and well, then how could someone avoid becoming a Christian? The Christian, I think, sees or ought to see the truth of Christianity shouting from every flower, from sunsets, from the stars at night, as well as from history and science and philosophy. But to those who do not believe, they're often blind to these things, and so that even the clearest arguments can just be dismissed. Our prayer needs to be that when we present the gospel, the various evidences for Christianity, it's not just about how clearly or how well we present them, but that God would change this person's spiritual blindness into sight. It makes us far more dependent on God than we often realize. Secondly, I mentioned at the beginning that as Christians it's easy to be intimidated by the vast ranks of intellectuals who often seem to dismiss what we think as a naive fairy tale. If anyone spends much time online or talking to atheists or non-Christians, you may have come across men like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Stephen Hawking, who scorn the idea of cross, the idea of God and the claims that Christianity makes. But what if the reason they are such convinced and zealous atheists is not because of their vast intelligence? It's not their intelligence that's led them to shrug off these quote-unquote childish beliefs. But rather, take for example Dawkins, because he's spiritually blind, that every organism and cell that he studies as a biologist is proclaiming to him the truth of Christianity. And it's not that the message isn't clear. The Pharisees did not grasp the beggar's argument, did not fail to grasp the beggar's arguments because the beggar didn't present them clearly. Rather, it was because of their blindness. And it's that same blindness that drives atheism and all anti-Christian thought today. Sometimes these people, though, are in high positions in places of power. We can look at a far more indirect claim of Christianity, that there are only two genders, say. That ought also to be perfectly obvious. It's not difficult to grasp to anyone's mind whose mind functions as intended. But haven't we seen that many people are able to blind themselves to it? And in resisting this ideology and in standing for the truth, we may find ourselves, like this poor blind beggar, fighting alone, fighting against people with great authority and great status. We didn't read it earlier, but if you read it later, the beggar's family have deserted him. As far as we can tell, he has no friends. Even Jesus, from verses 8 to verse 34, is conspicuously absent. And because of his tenacious clinging to the truth, which he alone seems to grasp, in verse 34 he is cast out of the synagogue, cut off from his community, from his religion, and it might even have felt from God. But after being absent for so long, in verse 35, we read the word Jesus. He's left the beggar to fight this battle alone, but as soon as he has been cast out, as soon as he has no one left, Jesus goes and meets with him. Jesus stands with him when the beggar had no one else. We've thought a lot about spiritual darkness this evening, and there's a lot of spiritual darkness in the world. But for John, the great joy was, as he puts it in chapter 1, that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. And so our comfort can be that however blind we feel the world is, and however much darkness seems to surround us, that it cannot and will not defeat the purposes of God. And even if, like the blind beggar, the world casts us out, it's there that we find Jesus. And that's a great comfort.